Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. From politics, let's go to President Trump's budget proposal and his so-called skinny budget. Now, I'm sure by now that you've heard it calls for a $54 billion increase in military spending while seeking significant cuts across much of the rest of the federal government. But the Trump budget document doesn't really give us much detail. It's more of a policy priority statement. So one of the topics I want to pursue today are what are the implications of this budget blueprint for thinking about prospects for innovation and entrepreneurship in the U.S. economy. And I also want to learn more about what's the process, all right? The administration has put out its budget proposal, but what happens next and how realistic is it that much of this will be accepted? So my guest today is Rosabeth Kanter. She's a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Professor Kanter has been in the forefront of researching, writing, consulting on the wellsprings of innovation and entrepreneurship throughout her career. Welcome, Professor Kanter.
Thank you very much.
And we're also joined by Kelsey Snell. She covers Congress with a focus on budget and fiscal issues for The Washington Post. Glad you
Thanks
could join
so much
us.
Thank you for having me.
And now, to our listeners, what advice do you have for Congress as they review President Trump's budget proposals? What are your budget priorities? Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828, and online at talk@nprnews.org. Rosabeth, I want to start off with you. And you know, you do all this work in innovation. So when you see the Trump administration's blueprint, what are your thoughts? What are the implications of this for innovation in the U.S. economy?
So first of all, I think they're bad overall, unless that $54 billion for the military is all going to be to design better aircraft or things that might actually have some impact on business in America and the quality of life in America, although I doubt that. Are they going to be the ones who are going to develop new forms of energy? Are they going to be the ones who create innovations in the life sciences? All those other agencies, not all of them, but many of them, play a role in innovation. And there's a time lag between the investments made in basic research, which can't depend on private money. They're classic public goods. Support universities, support research labs, support scientists. There's a lag between those discoveries and when they show up in new products, in innovation, in new businesses. And so today, our current job creation is on the backs of discoveries, innovations created maybe 10 years ago. So I think we have to keep investing in those areas of knowledge because that's America's great strength and why in many sectors, we are number one in the world.
So, Kelsey, I mean, there are obviously many people, Republicans and Democrats in Congress, but when you talk to people, does the message that Rosabeth is giving us, does that resonate? Is this a conversation that's going on as people in Congress react to this budget?
You know, I don't know that anybody is, I shouldn't say anybody, I don't think the majority of Republicans in Congress are thinking of this as an innovation-forward budget. I think they're thinking about it as resetting priorities. They feel generally like the past 8 years have been 8 years of big government spending, and they see this budget as an opportunity to kind of send a message that they are a different party with a different approach, and whether or not these things are enacted, which very likely many of these things will not be enacted, but the idea is they want the American people to know that they are a party of making cuts and that this will not be a big spending government under their watch. Though I would point out, though, that, you know, some in Congress, they don't necessarily get on board with the president's budget, never really have. The president's budget is kind of a first step. It's a request to Congress, and it is as much a campaign document as anything that was put out during the actual campaign. It's about setting up priorities for the White House, and Congress has never really adopted a budget in full, even when they agreed completely with the president.
So what is the process now? So the president has made his budget proposal. He's put it out there. Congress can now react. So what happens next?
Well, we're expecting that Congress will start the process of doing a budget sometime soon. In all technicality, they actually are supposed to get a budget done by the end of this month. But that is not a deadline that is ever met, and it's non-binding. It's supposed to give guidance to – actually, I'm sorry, end of next month. I keep thinking we're in April. it's a guidance document. And, you know, it's important for them to set out a budget at some point because, you know, it gives them the top-line spending numbers, which are the very wonky world of Congress, they set out the top line numbers for our appropriators, and the appropriators are the ones who actually do the spending. So it's, you know, it's a multi-tiered process that will probably not likely resolve itself for many, many months ahead.
So, Rosabeth, I mean, part of this discussion off of what Kelsey is saying is, look, yeah, there's this research stuff, but what we're really doing is unleashing the animal spirits of capitalism. We're going to reduce the role of government in our economy. We're going to reduce taxes. We're going to have less regulation. And so therefore, yeah, there are going to be cuts, but our priority is we're going to free up the private sector.
I think that there are many small business owners that would agree with that and feel their animal spirits have been held back. But we have to remember that even Silicon Valley, our great now supposed engine of forward-thinking, innovative companies, maybe not always forward-thinking, Massachusetts, my home state, my home region, other places that are innovation hubs around the country, they depend on research discoveries. They help seed the economy with new developments, and those animal spirits are made possible because there's a new platform, there's a discovery, there is some partnership, particularly, again, the life sciences more than other parts of technology, but advances in health that everybody enjoys, things that keep our society at the cutting edge, solve problems. So I'm not saying that I want necessarily a fat federal government. I just think that we ought to be scrutinizing these kinds of cuts against what are their longer-term implications, not just I would like to have more money in my pocket now, and by the way, we'll crowdsource investments in a new weather satellite.
So let's go to Kevin from Minneapolis. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
So,
you know, it doesn't matter what part of the budget is being cut. You guys managed to find somebody who's going to be a victim of that cut. But you never bother to consider that if you add up federal, state, and county budgets. We're spending over 60% of the economy and all of the innovation that's being destroyed and jobs that aren't being produced because we're being taxed at 60 to 65% of GDP.
Okay. So I'll toss this one to Rosabeth because actually this follows just nicely off of what – and thank you for your question, Kevin. That follows nicely off of what you were saying.
So, Kevin, I certainly – know that people are hurt in any budget. Some people are advantaged. Some people are not advantaged. Why are we spending all that on the military? Why don't we spread some of that around to these other areas that help fuel the economy? And, in fact, we have been creating jobs. We have been creating jobs. And I know there are some small businesses holding back from expanding because they feel they pay too much in taxes. I wasn't asked to comment about taxes. I was asked to comment about the impact on innovation. And we will fall behind. We are now ahead. In telecom, we are ahead of the world, but we don't always use our own innovations, in part because we don't have enough support for the kinds of things that will help us do it. The National Weather Service would be cut. We depend every day on that data to shape our lives. And yes, there are a lot of businesses that have grown up using the National Weather Service data, but they depend on the National Weather Service for the basic data.
So, Kelsey, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to pursue is, I believe in April we're having another debt ceiling limit issue.
Actually, the debt limit, so technically, yes, but in actuality, no. So technically, the debt limit will be reached likely sometime in April, but the Treasury Department has access to what they call extraordinary measures. And I think that, you know, that's a scary sounding term, but
right.
In reality, extraordinary measures are really just the usual functions of the Treasury Department, and they depend a little bit upon how much tax receipts that they get from corporations that submit on a quarterly basis. Long story short, they can stretch this out until probably November. The bigger thing that we have coming up in April, at the end of April, is that they need to pass another spending bill, because at the end of last year, Congress only passed a short-term spending bill, something we called a continuing resolution, or a CR. So if you hear people on TV talking about a CR, that's a short-term spending bill. And so it was only set up to fund the government through just about the end of April. And they will have to make some big decisions about whether or not they want to keep government spending flat and adhere to a 2015 agreement that was reached, a bipartisan, bicameral agreement in 2015 to set spending targets for 2 years. And if they stick with that, it should be pretty easy. But things aren't always easy in Congress, even when they seem like they should be.
I'm shocked to hear that. Let's see. Let's go to David from St. Paul. How are you doing, David?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just want to say, I think when I think about regulations, they're protections for people and citizens. And also, so when you take these away, I'll give an example of the coal miner rule that was the dumping of coal pollution into rivers. So when you take away that rule, you lose innovation, because it takes, if you have the regulations in place, you're protecting people from, you're protecting air and water, and you lose the innovation in the sense that no one has to come up with a scrubber to be able to treat the pollution, or to come up with a cleaner system for the coal. And also, as that happens, if we do cut these regulations, other countries are not going to come. They're going to go towards a cleaner energy system. So the United States might be left behind in that aspect. Other countries are going to get so much farther ahead of us if there's no innovation left in the country.
Yeah. So, David, I'm glad you asked this. And Rosabeth, I mean, this is one of the big issues, the cost, the benefits of regulation, but also the cost and benefits of regulation in a global economy.
So David is so right on, because I was also thinking of the EPA and clean air rules. They have stimulated the creation of clean energy industries. And America could lead the world in that. Actually, China is moving very fast to create clean energy industries. They need it, but then so do we. And that's a kind of race for industries of the future. And that's the kind of thing that when we have to pay our tax bills this year, almost immediately, if you haven't already.
It's coming up, the deadline, April 18th.
Yeah, when you're writing those checks, it feels like, oh, I don't want to have to pay that much. But this is our future. We want the roads fixed. We want the potholes fixed. We want better transportation. There's a lot of innovation that's going to go into doing that, although it's going to cost us some money. There are departments in the federal government that are pushing apprenticeships that will help people get job skills. In the left-behind regions of the country, there are employers who are looking for people who have certain skills, can't find enough of those skills. In part, it's because we don't have enough community college systems, apprenticeships, etc., that will help fuel the skills people need for the industries of the future. So it all fits together. It's hard to just separate out innovation. I would say it has to do with investing in a strong future. And the military has been a source of innovation, as I said at the beginning of the program. And the microwave oven was initially a military invention, but we can't count on that for our innovation. And meanwhile, it's a destructive force. It's not something that builds. I have great respect for the military, but I want to build the future economy.
So let's go to Russ from Anoka. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning. So I'll try to be as succinct as possible.
Sure.
I'll make reference to the United States Treasury Department webpage, U.S. Historical Debt Outstanding. According to that, the last time the United States debt, was paid down by even $1 was 1929. So it is irrelevant whether Democrats or Republicans or both have control of any of the branches or all three of the branches. Both parties are fiscally malfeasant. when we continue to go perpetually deeper and deeper into debt for 8 decades, that's not fiscal responsibility. Now, it could be argued that debt is irrelevant because it depending on what the GDP is. If the GDP goes up, debt is a small percentage of GDP. But when GDP goes down, the percentage of debt increases proportionately. Now, we pay around $300 billion a year just to pay the interest. Right. So it's like a credit card where someone is only paying the interest down on a credit card.
Yeah, no. And I think you've really hit on something, Russ, that a lot of people sort of share this notion of the debt always just seems to grow and the interest bill there. And boy, if I ran my household that way, I'd be in real financial trouble. So, Kelsey, I'm sure you've run across this over and over again.
Yeah. So the thing that we often tell in reporting, one of the things we often explain to people is that the federal government just isn't the same as trying to balance your checkbook. It works really differently. And it just doesn't work that way. And as much as it would be nice to try to make it cleanly explained that way, you have to remember that the federal government works on a whole different range of ways of receiving money and spending money. And it's also really difficult to just explain the budget in a vacuum, because Republicans have argued that, you know, their budget is also tied to the tax cuts that they would like to do and the deductions that they would like to see for businesses to allow them to expense more of their upfront research spending. And they say that, you know, that they are putting together a comprehensive economic plan. And Democrats have an obviously very different view on this. But if we look at the budget in just a vacuum that way, it's really hard to really get a picture of what our economy looks like. And this budget is also important to point out, only represents about one third of all federal spending. One third of spending falls under this bucket of what we call a discretionary spending. The rest is under mandatory spending, which is another type of spending on things like Social Security and Medicare and some payments to the VA and some of the debt payments. That mandatory spending makes up a far greater portion of overall federal spending than the budget that we're talking about today.
So, Kelsey, what is the sense on Capitol Hill? I mean, President Trump campaigned, and quite forcefully, and I think it was one of the reasons why many people voted for him or were attracted to him, was he said, look, what's wrong with Social Security? You know, hey, this is a good thing. Leave it alone. Medicare, that's fine. So is the sense on Capitol Hill that the entitlement spending is going to remain safe?
Well, I think that a lot of Republicans that I talk to say that they hope that they will gently guide the president, is how one of them referred to me, towards looking at the far larger portion of federal spending that comes through entitlement spending. The president has not shown any real willingness to do this. He told the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, which is this group of about 40 hardline conservatives in the House, he told the chairman, Mark Meadows, that he was not particularly interested in dealing with entitlements. Though I will say that Republicans in the House particularly think that they have a closer ear to the president now that Mick Mulvaney, who was one of the founding members of the Freedom Caucus, is the director of the OMB. So they think that they are going to be able to influence the president in a way that we haven't necessarily seen is doable.
So, Roosevelt, I want to follow up on something that you were saying. One of the things, I go to a lot of conferences and CEOs, academics like yourself, consultants, they all talk about the importance of human capital and creativity. That sort of like is the two code words, human capital for education and skill, creativity for coming up with those ideas that transform our economy. What's the next iPhone that, you know, has such a big influence on our economy? And one of the things in this budget is it seems to sort of dismiss both human capital and creativity. I know arts organizations and creativity aren't exactly the same thing, but it kind of goes against this sort of arts cultural side of our economy. And it also sort of says, you know, this retraining budgets, these training budgets, we're going to make some cuts there.
So first of all, there's lots of room to be more efficient in the spending. And there are lots of criticisms that people have who even favor those ideas and those kinds of agencies in the arts, in education, in health research, National Institute of Health, know that things could be more efficient, could be better. In fact, there was a move on the part of the one government research entity to make sure that the metric for any grant was also the practical applications that would stem from it. So we know there's room for more efficiency, but that doesn't mean we should cut it out altogether. There's room for a little government stimulus. Here's one example. I mean, Sesame Street has provided early childhood education for decades of children by offering it for free over public broadcasting. And to lots of kids who would otherwise not get early literacy, early math skills, and now they get it. Are they smarter? Well, data show that Sesame Street has had a bigger impact on improving childhood education than almost early childhood education than almost any other program. Cutting PBS won't take Sesame Street off the air. They have a deal now with HBO, but it will mean that it won't get for free into every household where there are kids who can't afford cable television. So the government, yes, is spending on things that will stimulate the future of the knowledge base we need. That's the other reason that we succeed in America, is because of the creativity built into our education. And innovation is a longer-term proposition. That's the other thing about it. So we pay our taxes individually as voters, as consumers. That feels immediate. We see the hit in our checkbook. Congress gets elected every 2 years, so they have a time horizon that's not very long because they start running for re-election almost immediately. But this question of what kind of innovation can we create by making longer-term investments? We should think of this as investments, and there should be room in the federal budget for a capital expenditure line and not simply expensing everything year by year. And all these agencies and the National Endowment for the Arts, the Public Broadcasting Corporation for Public Broadcasting, AmeriCorps, National Service has had a discernible impact on keeping kids in school, on getting important things done in communities. And in fact, Congress people who have an AmeriCorps program in their community tend to be much more positive about the Corporation for National Service than those who don't. All those things are investments in a longer-term future, and arguably they shouldn't be voted on in appropriation year by year.
You know, Kelsey, this notion of having a capital account, an investment account, sort of separating out what the government is doing more in an investment line, comes up again and again. Much of a conversation this time around?
Almost always a conversation about budget process reform that bubbles up every year in Congress. I actually spoke on a panel about it last year, and I'm due to speak on a panel about it again this year, and I assume that I will do it again the year after that. It is the thing about reforming any kind of process here in Washington is that it takes a lot of time, it
yeah.
takes a lot of goodwill, and it takes a lot of willingness to set aside momentary needs. So on budget process reform, you would have to have a lot of trust that both sides of the equation could see the forest for the trees and could say, you know, maybe we make some changes now in order to have equity when maybe we're not in power in the future. And that is not always the strong suit of Congress.
Particularly now, I think.
Yeah. And I think that it's important to remember that one of the things that there's a moderating force here in Washington, and it's supposed to be the U.S. Senate. They come up for re-election only every 6 years, not every two, and they have a longer-term view on things. And they are often when something passes the House, it can come out as a seemingly skewed to one side, left or right, piece of legislation. Then it comes to the Senate, and oftentimes it gets slowed down. They think about it, they change it, and it becomes a little bit more reflective of the moderated middle. We're seeing less and less of that right now, but I think particularly in the years ahead with President Trump, you may see that the Senate tries to return a bit to that moderating force. There's a reason it's called the world's greatest deliberative body, and I think there are some who are institutionalists around here who hope that it will regain that mantle.
So what would you like to see the Senate think about? What would you like them to prioritize in the budget? If you call us at 651-227-6000, toll free, 1-800-242-2828, or you can email us at talk@nprnews.org. And let's go to Mike from St. Paul. How are you doing, Mike?
Doing well, thank you.
So what's your comment?
You know, at the end of last year, there was a report that was produced by Obama administration about the waste in the Pentagon budget. And it didn't get a lot of press play, but it indicated that there was like $100 billion of waste, or at least duplication, mainly in pretty mundane things like HR within the military. And but, you know, the businessman we voted in was supposed to take that sort of waste and abuse and fix it, as opposed to now a $52 billion increase just rewarding them for the same.
Yeah.
So it's just it's frustrating when one reason why some people voted for him was to look at things differently and to make you know, take a businessman's perspective in making things at least efficient, and doesn't seem to happen.
No, thank you very much for this question. And Kelsey, how much of a look is the defense budget getting these days? Because, you know, they got this big increase. It is already a very large budget. And whether it's, you know, this $100 billion figure or not, you know, how much of this is, do we really, how much are we delving into that defense budget?
Very, very, very little. It's one of the only agencies in the federal government that does not receive an audit. There is a big movement within some circles in Washington pushing for an audit of the Pentagon. It's unclear to me how much that will move. There are people, like very influential people, who would like to see that happen. We are seeing the quite vulnerable Senate Democrat Joe Manchin in West Virginia is one of the people who's saying that he is fine with the increasing military spending, but he wants to see an audit first and see that how the money is being spent. But I it's unclear to me how far that move will push. I think that there's a resistance because people will often say that doing an audit of military spending gives, you know, people, enemies abroad, if you want to call them that, a chance to see what the internal workings of our military is.
So let's go to Mark, and I believe, Mark, you're from North Oaks. Is that right?
Yes. I just had two quick comments.
Sure.
The first caller you had quoted a wildly inaccurate number.
Right. The share of federal GDP, yes. And state and locally added in. Yeah.
Well, federal is 15. Yeah. State and local barely add up to that. It's nowhere near 60%. It's less than half of what he's talking about. The federal workforce is the lowest it's been in 50 years. And that share of GDP, by the way, is the lowest it's been in 50 years. Federal government's been shrinking. People may want it to shrink more. That's fine. But you shouldn't base your argument on a lie. The second thing is, we are first because of research. And research does not mean applied research. It doesn't mean technical research. It means research at all levels. We would not have nanotechnology without basic science research that was supported when people had no idea what they were looking for or what it could be used for. And we have maintained our position through a strong structure with basic science and applied science. And this budget is just tearing at the roots of it.
You know, Rosabeth, Mark raises an interesting point. I mean, when we think about some of the research that the federal government funds, a lot of it is throwing spaghetti up against the wall. And so by definition, some of that spaghetti is just going to fall to the ground, but some of it's going to stick.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize most of it as spaghetti against the wall, because there's always something to learn, even from a failed project. But I agree with the centrality of science. Well, this is a budget that doesn't seem to, an administration that hasn't shown real support for science and the facts that science make possible. I think that's important. And I also want to comment briefly on something Kelsey said, because it has an innovation and a research and a knowledge element, and that is that there may be resistance to auditing the military because there'd be information that goes to our enemies. Well, because of innovation, our enemies seem to be able to hack into anything. in the U.S. government. In part, it's enemies who spend a lot more time on math education and have many more and very sophisticated programmers. Russia invests a great deal in programming skills. We don't in America. So the best defense is a good offense. We need to be investing not just in science, but also in the skills that are going to support the ways we use data in the future. And again, that doesn't necessarily, isn't going to sway the person on the street corner, small business person in a mom and pop shop, unless we also spend time educating people about the value of all of this, and we don't. So I think that's incredibly important. So education has to play a very big role, and we can't be cutting the budgets for the things that are going to support standards in education. The federal government doesn't do education, but the Department of Education supports standards because, as we say, algebra is the same whether you're in Alabama or Alaska.
Exactly. So let's go to Steve. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good, thank you. I have good. 2 points. One,
I'm going to ask you to keep. We got the tyranny of the clock is working against us, so
yeah. Okay.
I'm going to ask you just to keep it succinct, please.
I agree with the last caller. And secondly, you're talking about how to divide up the crumbs. The real issue is we need to expand the tax base so because we can afford as a country to take care of all of our problems. Congress is just not making that decision.
Okay,
that's what I have to say.
So thank you. Kelsey, that leads to one of the questions I want to ask you, which is how does this budgetary process interact with the whole thing about how are we going to tax corporations and individuals, which is going to be a big topic of discussion going forward?
It doesn't actually interact all that much, unfortunately, at this point. It will eventually get to that point where they interact about, you know, how much they need it in revenue. The question, I think the central question about tax reform right now is whether or not they want this reform to be revenue neutral, which means that the government would bring in the same amount of money as it brought in. It'll in the future bring in the same amount of money as it brings in today. That question is up in the air. A lot of Republicans say that they don't need to do that and they want to cut the revenue so they can cut the spending. I do want to return really quickly to something that Rosabeth said. It is so important for people to understand that while this is not a budget that will likely be enacted, a vision statement is a vision statement, and it tells people, you know, how you're going to enact your priorities going forward and how you may make decisions about things related to those priorities. So while these exact things in the White House budget may not make it to law, they represent how the government thinks about spending right now.
Well, thank you very much. And unfortunately, our hour has come to an end because I could keep going. And I've enjoyed this conversation and the calls that we've gotten. So I want to thank Rosabeth Kanter. She's a professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. And Kelsey Snell covers Congress with a focus on budget and fiscal issues for The Washington Post.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Lot.